Hello and welcome to CityWire's Funds Fanatic Show. I'm Jeremy Gordon, Assistant Editor of Funds Insider at CityWire, and I'm joined on the podcast today by Jupiter's Dan Carter. Dan runs two funds investing in Japanese stocks, Jupiter Japan Income and Jupiter Japan Select, and more than £1 billion of assets with colleague Mitesh Patel. Japan has, of course, been in the spotlight lately, with Tokyo hosting a unique pandemic Olympics and the Paralympics soon to follow. Meanwhile, the Japanese stock market is still often seen by turns as a neglected land of opportunity and something of a basket case. And I'm particularly interested to hear from Dan today, which it is, because I actually used to live in Japan for 2 years myself. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Nice to be on.
Fantastic. Okay, so first question from me. What one of former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's aims was to turn Japan into what he called a normal country. I think that was more about geopolitics, but do you think Japan has become a more normal place to invest to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got to be slightly careful to define what we're comparing Japan to and what we mean by normal, really. I mean, I think if you showed the investment landscape as it is now globally to anybody who is investing anywhere in the world before the global financial crisis, I don't think they would think very much about it was normal. Anyway, so we've got to be a little bit careful about that. But I know what you mean. I think that there are some peculiarities or some distinctive features about Japanese equity market and investing in Japan which remain. But in some ways, Japan has become a little bit more like some Western markets. So I think, you know, one way in which people often talk about this is with respect to corporate governance and essentially the relationship between companies and shareholders. So I think that has kind of normalized in the sense that it's become a little bit more like global best practice, or at least it's on that sort of journey. So I think the answer is basically yes, but there are still some pretty peculiar things about investing in Japan that do make it quite a distinctive and we think quite interesting place to be.
Okay, thanks, Dan. Well, I'm sure we can get on to some of those, but first a word on the Olympic Games. The Olympics are much more about symbolism rather than having any, you know, real effect on a country's economy. But maybe it is also a natural point to check in. What's the coronavirus situation like in Japan at the moment? And is its economic recovery stalling?
Yes. Yeah, so again, it kind of really depends what you're comparing it to and how you define these things. So the headlines will tell you that it's a disaster. The headlines will tell you that, you know, greater swathes of Japan are being put into, a situation of national emergency. And we all watch the Olympics with no spectators in the stands, etc. And in terms of, you know, more positive cases coming through and the Delta variant sort of really ripping through the country as it is ripping through the rest of the world and certainly through Asia, you know, that is true. That is true. So I don't want to sort of sugarcoat this at all. That is all happening. And one of the reasons why that's happening is because the vaccination program in Japan is now not slow, as in the rate of uptake is not low, but it started off very slowly. So actually it's kind of retarded, really. It's just been held back a little bit. So that's not great. That's all the negative stuff. But actually, you know, again, when all of this is settled and we look back at Japan versus other countries, other regions, you know, even other major markets, I think Japan will look rather better than the headlines are suggesting now. So if you look at the number of fatalities that are attributed to COVID since the pandemic began in Japan, we're just over 15,000 at the moment. And of course, that number's climbing all of the time. But this is a population of 120 million people. It's also extremely aged. So, you know, compare that to the UK and the situation we're in with, you know, I think more than 120,000 people have lost their lives to COVID and a younger and smaller population. Japan doesn't look too bad, right? Japan doesn't look too bad. So it's pretty nuanced. It's a bit worrying and it is stalling the recovery a bit. Again, Japan just feels like it's been held back by the vaccination issue. But again, you know, when this is all done and dusted and, well, who knows when that's going to be and the extent to which that's going to be. But when we look back on this, I think Japan will actually come out of it okay. And it'll be timing issues, which we will which we'll be attributing, you know, various rates of recovery to.
Okay, thanks, Dan. One other Olympics-related thing I did want to ask about was Japan has been or had been enjoying a bit of a tourism surge in recent years. Now, I know you do have some property investments in the portfolio. I don't know if that's something you've been playing, but I mean, what do you think about that theme?
Yeah, you're right. Japan had been enjoying a tourism surge, and you know, as you said in the intro, you've been to Japan. You spent some considerable time there, and I've been to Japan plenty of times, and it's a fantastic place to visit. And I think that more tourists, you know, should go. And this was coming from a very, very low base, but Japan was growing the number of tourists it was welcoming. You're very considerably on a year-on-year basis, and it was a government scheme as well. It was a priority for the government to get more people to come to Japan and enjoy everything that it has to offer, and clearly stimulate the economy a bit while they're there. But it was, you know, I think it was kind of pushing on an open door because Japan's got a lot to offer. The pandemic has clearly derailed that. You're absolutely right. You know, it's essentially impossible to visit Japan at the moment. But again, we do hope that that's temporary. And the, you know, the factors which were bringing more and more visitors to Japan, I think are pretty persistent. One is what Japan offers, and I don't think that's going to change. I mean, it's a, you know, fantastic culture and great cuisine and welcoming people and all of that sort of stuff, culture, service. So lots of things to like about Japan. And also, you know, when we consider where those people were coming from, I mean, they were coming from all over the world, but they were sort of disproportionately coming from the rest of Asia, and in particular from China. So to an extent, it was a function of, you know, a growing middle class in China with more money to spend, more willingness and ability to go out there and visit places. So I think that will come back. With respect to the equity market and the way that was sort of playing out in portfolios, to be honest, it had kind of run its course a little bit before, mm-hmm. you know, before the Olympics, really. That was something that was very, very meaningful as a actually fairly short-term driver of specific stock returns in, I think, kind of 2015, 2016, maybe that sort of era. And since then, it has cooled. And one of the reasons it's cooled is purely because of economics. I mean, if you look at some, you know, something like hotels, yeah, there was a shortage of hotels in Japan and particularly in Tokyo, and you know, they were a pretty good business when they started getting fuller and fuller and more people started spending money there. But then, of course, what happens is that drags in capital, and you've had an awful lot of new hotels developed and old hotels knocked down and new ones built in their place in Japan. So you've had a supply increase as well. So in terms of actually playing that out in portfolios, it hasn't really been hugely meaningful for the last couple of years. But in general, it should be a supportive factor, bringing a little bit more consumption sort of verve to the country as people do start coming back.
Okay, thanks very much, Dan. So let's turn a bit more closely to the funds that you and Mitesh manage. How long have you been running them, and what's the basic approach?
Yeah, so I started Jupiter in 2008, and then took over responsibility for running both of the Japan funds in 2016. Prior to that, I'd been running one of them since 2013. Mitesh joined me in 2016 as well, and we run the funds on a very collaborative basis. These funds are, as you will guess, they're Japanese equity funds, but they're funds that are generating returns in excess of the overall market by combining two factors which pull in different directions. That is what we're trying to do. So these funds both have, and they are identical, by the way, on a line-by-line basis, they're identical to one another.
Yeah.
That they have dual premia of dividend yield, so higher dividend yield than the benchmark, than the market average, but also higher or faster underlying earnings growth than the average. And the point here really is that we are trying to be core. We are trying to be somewhere in the middle. We do have these biases, but we're not an extreme growth at any price fund. We're not a deep value fund. We are sitting somewhere in the middle. And if you're in the middle, what you're not doing is you're not selling a particular style and giving your clients as much of it as you possibly can. What you must be doing, we think, is finding pockets of inefficiency in the market and exploiting them to the benefit of your clients. So that's what we're trying to do. And the way that we do that is the framework that I just talked about, because in a perfectly efficient market, you'd get a really good trade-off between growth and income. You wouldn't be able to put together a portfolio which is both higher yielding and faster growing than the market average. It just wouldn't be possible. But the fact that we can and do suggest to us that we are getting more out of the market than it wants to give us, and therefore sowing the seeds of positive investment performance. So that's really what we're trying to do. Yeah. And you know, the different stocks that we have all play into that. They all play different roles, and you know, pulling the fund in those general directions that we want it to go. But the overall thesis is, you know, we want to outperform the market on the inputs. We want to get more of those good things in the fund than the market average. And if we do, then we'll get more of the good stuff out. We'll get more of that total return investment performance.
Yeah. Can you share with us any recent buys that sort of encapsulate what you're looking for, or any holdings which really show those themes working through?
Yeah. So as I said, we try and do this all the way across the portfolio. So you know, if you can imagine, if you want a fund which has premium yields and premium growth, obviously you can try and find businesses that have both a premium yield and premium growth, you know, in that particular individual company. And we do that. You know, we do that. If you look at companies like, we've got an online mortgage broker, which is a very disruptive business in the financial sector called Aruhi. That's a business that is both growing faster than the average, but it's also on a super premium yield as well. And there are reasons for that, of course. The reasons are, you know, people just instinctively don't like anything to do with housing in Japan, for example,
right,
and other things as well. But so there's always a reason why we end up with these situations in those particular stocks. But when we find them, we like to get onto them. You know, we do like to play those. Another area in which we've done that in the past is technology, which, you know, is hugely in favor at the moment, but has been hugely out of favor in the past. And when we get whole sectors like that, that we think through the cycle can generate really nice growth, but are massively out of favor, that allows yields, dividend yields, to rise. So we can get businesses that we think, you know, on a mid to longer term basis are premium growth, but at the same time are premium yielding. That said, there's not a population of companies in Japan which is sufficiently large to sustain a whole portfolio where you have both premium yield and premium growth in the same stock, in the same company. So what we've got to do, therefore, is we've got to look at other ends of the yield spectrum, right? We've got to look at higher yielding companies that you would expect to have no or very, very limited growth, and for which actually there is much more meaningful growth than you would expect. So a company like Roland, for example. So Roland, I don't know if you or any of the listeners are musicians, but you know, the electronic musical instrument company makes,
right, of course.
Makes keyboards and electric pianos and electric drums, and also Boss effects pedals for electric guitars, things like that. That's a business that it listed at the back end of last year, and we participated in that. We think that's a business that can grow, you know, easily in the mid to higher single digits in the midterm, right? That's a business that we think can generate profit growth of 6, 7, maybe 8%, and actually is doing a little bit better than that at the moment. But when that came to the market, it was on a yield of more than 3%. And for 3% yielders in Japan, you just don't find 6, 7, 8% growers. You find growers at 1 or 2% at best, and often considerably lower. So trying to get conspicuously high growth for the amount of yield is something we try and do. And then the other thing that we try and do is try and find businesses which have, you know, conspicuously high yield for the amount of growth, you know, even if the amount of yield is not in and of itself really, really high. So again, if we can find businesses that are growing, you know, not 5, 6, 7%, but are growing on a mid-teens number, mid-teens percentage, something like that, then we're going to be looking to buy those when their yields are higher than you'd think, i.e. the yields should be more or less zero, and they're not. They're 1, 1.5%, something like that. So there are a number of different ways in which we look to achieve this portfolio level end, and there's just a couple of names that we've been participating in recent months or years that have helped to do that.
Okay, thanks very much, Dan. And well, we kind of touched on a bit, but something I'd like to ask in a way so I don't forget to ask it. There are a lot of varying perceptions about Japan. Like, alternately, you know, there are some very high-tech companies. It's got this amazing manufacturing base. People say it's this kind of deep value area. But why should prospective investors look at Japan? What's the essential thing there?
I mean, from our point of view, as active investors, the thing that we like about it the most is actually entirely divorced from all of those things that you mentioned. Yeah. Entirely divorced from all of the sort of macro stuff. I mean, I'll get onto that in a second. But the thing that we like about it the most is that it's really, really inefficient. There's a massive amount of opportunity here. And when we talk about opportunity, we are really talking about inefficiency. When we look at the way that we run money and the way that I think, you know, in general, active managers can add value, it is through finding pockets of inefficiency. And if you've got a market which is, you know, absolutely, you know, as rational as you can possibly get and crawled over by sell side research analysts and you know, really well broked and very well known and very well covered, where, you know, price discovery is very rapid, then frankly, you've got a really, really tough job on your hands trying to outperform it. You know, I think that's a terrible place to invest. So that's why, you know, I don't want to do the US down, but I think the US must be a really difficult place to invest. And Japan is kind of the antithesis of that. You've got a massive population of companies. You've got 3,500, if not more, listed companies in Japan. Many of them are very, very small. But you know, even for a billion-pound fund or strategy like ours, you know, we can invest in probably anything up to 1,500 different companies. That very, very large population of companies. So very many of them are frankly just not that well known. And there are lots and lots of other things that are playing into the market, and increasing that sort of ambient level of inefficiency. So if you're a, you know, if you're an active manager, I think Japan is somewhere to be, you know, somewhere to be enjoyed, right? There's huge amounts of opportunity. You've got to go out there and take it. I think from an absolute return perspective, which is the perspective that many clients still look at this from, which I think is perfectly reasonable. You know, why bother with Japan? Like, sure, maybe you think you can outperform it over time because of the inefficiency, but what about the, you know, the average level of the market? Is that going to be any good, or are you going to be outperforming something that's going to be going down the tubes? Well, I think there's a few things to bear in mind there. I think on a very short-term basis, Japan does look like a bit of a coiled spring. And we talked about this earlier on in the discussion, that Japan has been held back in its recovery from COVID. And you can see that in the equity market as well. So Japan has underperformed most major markets on a year-to-date basis, which, you know, is frustrating, but at the same time, we think sows the seeds for a catch-up. Right. So when Japan does normalize, when consumption, you know, does rally back from its current suppressed level, now the Olympics are out the way, we're still going to do the Paralympics, of course. But when that whole sort of festival of sport is over and done with, the political imperative for the government to be very, very tight on restrictions will lift a little bit. And when we look at consumption versus consumer confidence, right? How much is actually being spent versus how much consumers want to spend? There's a big gap there. So consumers do want to spend more. And when they can, when they're allowed to, we think they will. So I think that there's a short-term rally on the way. We have to, all sorts of things can come through and derail that. So we have to be humble when we say that sort of thing. But I think there are reasons to believe that things will look brighter on a short-term level, you know, in 3, 6, 9 months' time than they do now for those reasons. And then on a longer-term basis, really that's when we have to think about the changes which are going on within the Japanese corporate sector. And these aren't new changes. I'm not really talking about inflections, or if I am, they're inflections that have already happened. You know, we're talking about trends that have been established for a little while. We often talk about how Japan is perceived as being really mean, as being a sort of mean place or a mean corporate sector. It doesn't like shareholders. And at the same time, it's kind of really old, you know, and we talked briefly about demographics earlier on. There's a grain of truth in that as well. And it's unprofitable, right? These are the things that people don't like. And all of these things actually are either, you know, just not quite right, or are creating conditions that are making it actually quite good for equity investors on a sort of perversely positive basis. So just really briefly to go through all of those, Japan is mean. Well, sure, it doesn't pay out as much as some of the major developed markets, but that is on the rise, right? So total payout ratios for Japan are going up, and certainly were going up pre-pandemic. And we expect, you know, the pressure on the corporate sector to continue to increase, both from people like us, but also from the government in Japan, to try and make sure that is the case. So this is a wind that is going to be on your back as an equity holder. So I think that's a good place to be. The other thing about demographics, sure, absolutely. You know, Japan is an old place, and I think that in the mid to longer term, you know, notwithstanding what I said about the recovery and consumption, you know, after COVID, I think consumption is going to be under pressure in Japan because people are getting older and they spend less money, you know, as they go onto fixed incomes and they, you know, they become pensioners. However, what that does is it structurally tightens the labor force. It means that labor goes from being a plentiful resource to a scarce one. And when you get a scarce resource like that, it starts to become allocated around the corporate sector better. So that pushes profitability up, right? It seems odd. It seems like a perverse, you know, bad news is good news, sort of slightly Orwellian sort of way of looking at it. But I think it's true, and it's certainly been true over the last few years, that that's forced the corporate sector to become more profitable. And that plays into the last point that I made, that Japan is coming from a relatively unprofitable position. If you look at the Japanese profitability versus other major developed markets, it is low, but it's going up, structurally going up. So again, these are all trends, sort of mega trends, multi-year mega trends.
Yes.
And you can have them if you want. You know, if you invest in Japan, you can have these. That's not to say there aren't other issues, but those mega trends, I think, are pretty powerful. And therefore, I think people should be interested in Japan.
Okay, thanks very much, Dan. And on the point about returns to shareholders, compared to some other markets, companies have been more reluctant to raise their dividends or improve returns through share buybacks. But as you say, that is a trend where we're seeing movement. Are there any examples in the portfolio where, you know, companies have started to return a lot more to shareholders?
Yeah, we've seen a number of these. We've seen a number of them. I mean, a couple that I'd particularly mention are coming from a relatively low base.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a position in an electronic connector company called Iriso Electronics, and that, you know, several years ago, a handful of years ago, when we initially took the position, had a payout ratio which was very, very low. It was in the teens. It was unjustifiably low. And this is a business that, quite frankly, you know, it didn't hate shareholders at all. It had just made an enormous amount of money. It had gone through a period of profitability, which was, you know, very pleasurable for them to go through, I'm sure, but it sort of caught them by surprise. You know, the emergence of electric vehicles, the increase in the electronic content of cars, you know, had meant that there was a demand boom for what they did, and more profits poured into that company. And they were just pretty old-fashioned, and they had a relatively fixed dividend policy, which meant that their payout ratio went down and down and down, and their cash position went up and up and up. And we engaged with that business an awful lot. And this is something we do continually, actually, where we think that there are businesses which should be paying out more to shareholders. We will be engaging with them to try and get them to do so. But to do that, you need to do it in a non-cynical fashion. Right. I mean, if you're a shareholder and you're just going and getting your begging bowl out and totally ignoring all other stakeholders, then I think that there is a risk that you get dismissed, certainly in Japan. So an argument, and I think it's often a legitimate argument, needs to be made that this is the best thing for the business to be run on a more efficient basis, you know, from the perspective of capital. So we did that there, and they have increased their payout ratio meaningfully. Another one, actually a very similar story, is a company called Hazama Ando. And that narrative is sort of emboldened a little bit because, you know, we are not the only shareholder that is doing that. And Hazama Ando has become really a target for a handful of activist investors. We don't consider ourselves activists, by the way. We are highly engaged, very active investors, but I don't think we're activist investors. We're not specifically seeking out these kinds of names throughout the whole of the portfolio and using this as the core reason for why we think we're going to outperform in the way that activists do. But we are very, very engaged, and other people are starting to try and urge companies to move in this same direction. So again, the same sort of story with Hazmat Ando. I mean, they started off with a very, very low payout ratio, and they've come to have a kind of normal payout ratio, which again isn't enough. Doesn't mean that we stop. And they can do an awful lot more because again, they've got huge cash on the balance sheet, which is, you know, is not rare in Japan. But they can and we hope will do more.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much, Dan. Before we move on to maybe talk about a few more companies in the portfolio in depth, I just wanted to ask, you know, how you got into managing Japanese equities in the first place? Because I think, like me, you have a bit of an affinity with Japan.
Yeah, it looks a bit odd, doesn't it? It does look a bit odd. It just seems like a sort of strange thing to dedicate one's career to. But I think, like a lot of these things, it really depends upon both motivation and opportunity. So the first thing on opportunity is, you know, I started my career at a fund management house in Scotland, which had a pretty well established and quite interesting Japanese equity team. I actually started my career doing UK equities, large cap UK equities. So there was a bit of a push factor because UK large cap equities, I've got to be careful because some of my colleagues cover them, but you know, it can be pretty dry. Right, you know, I was writing reports on British Plasterboard and other companies like that, and it wasn't quite as thrilling as I'd hoped it was going to be, and there was an opportunity to rotate round onto an interesting team where clearly there were lots and lots of, you know, fascinating companies about which I think, you know, people knew the brands, including me, but didn't really understand really very much about. So that was one thing, but then the motivation. I think you can look back and there's almost always some sort of, you know, personal hinterland that skews the probabilities of moving one way or another. And for Japan, it's often, you know, manga or anime or something like that. People are really into that. Or it's martial arts, right? People are dead into martial arts and that drags them towards Japan. And my sport is judo. Right, judo is the thing that I've spent, you know, a significant chunk of my life spending way too much time for far too little return doing. but I do love it, and I've loved it for a very long time. So that always made Japan a really interesting place for me. I had some degree of cultural affiliation or interest at the very least. So when it came around that I had the opportunity to essentially choose, you know, which market that I want to go and experience next, you know, Japan was one that I really wanted to go and try. And then having done it, again, it's the diversity of companies that you can invest in and look at, and the extent to which you can really get ahead of it, and you can know more about it than other people in a relatively short period of time. You know, that's a really thrilling thing for somebody who's relatively new to the game to be able to do. And in Japan, you can do that.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dan. That's a very, very interesting backstory. So kind of, well, coming back onto the fund and what you've been doing more recently, you know, I think we should point out the fund's performance has been strong in the last 5 years. To the end of July, returned about 61% versus 44% for the Topix, which is the kind of Japanese equivalent of the FTSE All Share. And you mentioned your process of looking for these inefficiencies, and the tech sector had been one place where you'd found a lot of that. I think that's probably not the case today. Valuations have gone up a lot. Has that been forcing you to be more creative in general?
Yes, it has. Yes, it has. I think we've had to be really creative, especially over the last couple of years, because you're right. The tech sector is a great example of this, but it's not the only example. You know, there are lots of other, you know, long runway, high quality investment themes and high quality businesses, which are, you know, utterly crawled all over by foreign investors, quite frankly, right. And foreign investors, you know, essentially, you know, are the determinants of price in the Japanese equity market. So when they get excited, that really does push up valuations. So you're right. As that has happened, we've had to become much more creative. And we've been creative typically within themes rather than outside of themes. So a good example of that, I mean, you know, you mentioned tech, and we do have a lower weighting to tech than we have in the past. Yeah. But even, you know, even before lowering that weighting, we were rotating considerably between positions. So one of the best performing positions that we have had in the portfolio over the last handful of years is a company called LaserTech, which essentially, you know, we bought as a small cap and sold as a large cap, which is exactly the journey you want to go on as an investor. This is a company which manufactures inspection devices for mask blanks and patterned masks. Those essentially the negatives which are used for printing chips onto silicon. And we're no longer shareholders of that. You know, that's something that really we thought became egregiously priced, and expectations were running away with it. Even though our expectations for it were still, you know, were pretty spectacular, those that were implied by the market yeah. were even more spectacular. So within that theme, you know, we looked around and found other businesses that we thought were exposed to the same sort of commercial opportunities. And that's really all we're talking about when we talk about themes, is commercial opportunities. You know, if it's good for one company, it's often good for a number of companies. And one of the businesses that we found that was kind of similar to LaserTech is a business called Geol, which makes okay. multi-beam mask writers. So it's an oligopolist in the manufacture of multi-beam mask writers. And these are the pieces of equipment which are used to pattern those masks that LaserTech tests. So when generating, you know, when generating those, essentially those negatives, it's equipment made by Geol, which is used to do that. And this wasn't really very well covered because it's buried relatively deep in a microscope business. But by, you know, going through the market with a pretty fine tooth comb, you know, we were able to find that business. Again, I don't want to sound sort of too self-congratulatory about this, but it's been on a pretty nice journey, right? Because other people have realized that this is to the benefit of this company as well as others. So I think on tech, I don't want to suggest that we're entirely at the end of the line, but the fact that we have reduced our weighting there does suggest, I think, that we've had quite a number of iterations within that sector of creativity, you know, trying to be more creative, more creative, more creative, more niche, more niche, more niche. And the risk with that, of course, is that in the search for inefficiency is that you just go smaller and smaller and smaller. And we've got to be very careful about doing that. You know, we do have a weighting towards small cap, but we don't want to be excessive about that. And so trying to find more creative large caps is something that we've spent an awful lot of time on in the last several months. And just to give you one example of that, which is kind of related to tech, but is certainly not a semiconductor production equipment company, is NEC, which, you know, somebody said to me the only thing good that NEC has ever done is sponsor Everton in the 1990s, which seems a bit harsh, but it does go to show that NEC had fallen quite considerably out of favor with investors in Japan. It was seen as really old, really staid, really unprofitable. And again, you know, all of these things, you know, have a grain of truth to them. But NEC has moved considerably out of the low profit areas of its business and focused much more on IT and software for domestic digital transformation. And, you know, this links back to something that you said about Japan being, you know, really whizzy and high tech on one hand, but actually being quite old fashioned in other ways. A Japanese corporate sector, in the way that it does its business, as well as the government, can be really old fashioned, but it is becoming much more modern, and it's spending a lot more money on software and other IT services to make that happen. NEC is one of the big facilitators of that, particularly for government. But it's also a business which is helping build next generation, so 5G mobile networks. And yeah. it's replacing Huawei in developed markets because, you know, for pretty obvious geopolitical reasons, Huawei has fallen well out of favor in many major developed markets. So NEC is stepping in. This is an area which was kind of generally interesting to investors, but would not but those investors would probably not have looked at this particular company because it had a bad rep, quite frankly. It had a bad rep as being really old and staid and unprofitable, but it's less old and it's less staid and it's more profitable than it has been in the past. And again, you know, we talk about the sort of the journey we want to go on, slightly cheesy, right? But it is the way that we think about these things, and NEC is starting on that journey. But it does take a degree of creativity, because, you know, the gold standard obvious plays on that, you know, wouldn't be NEC. It would be something else. Yeah. But it'd be, you know, hugely overpriced in our view and wouldn't offer much in the way of opportunity.
Thank you, Dan. Well, that's interesting. So a kind of, you know, storied name of the past coming back to the fore. That leads me on to the last thing I want to ask about, really. There are some big names that everyone will recognize in the portfolio. And one of those is Toyota. In fact, it's your top holding. I think it's about a 7% position at the end of July. Bridgestone, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the world's largest manufacturer of tyres and lots of other auto parts, is another top 10 holding. You know, why is that? What kind of state is the Japanese car industry in at the moment, and why are you backing those companies?
Yeah, so I think we've got to be
realistic.
We can
break it down to the Toyota and Bridgestone, if you like.
Yeah, it's all right. I mean, to be honest, there are common threads that run through them both, and I think Toyota, because it's a more technologically innovative company. I certainly don't want to do Bridgestone down, but it is tyres, right? Rather than anything else. You know, Toyota is a more interesting case study, I think. When we look at global autos, you know, as I said, we've got to be realistic. I think it's a sort of Hail Mary to really expect global auto volumes to grow very meaningfully from here. So what we need to do is we need to find businesses within that are going to be, you know, that are going to survive, that are going to succeed, that are going to grow share, that are going to potentially redefine what is meant by mobility. Uh-huh. Because the nature of travel and traveling relatively short distances and traveling on a sort of personal basis, you know, we now think of jumping in our car and driving somewhere. You know, if we're in the middle of a city, we might think of jumping in a taxi or an Uber or something like that. And that is very much more the way that the world is likely to move. You know, we need to think about this in sort of broader mobility terms rather than just, you know, certainly gas-guzzling cars. And Toyota has a kind of a PR problem. You know, it's a very big business, and it is a, you know, it's got a storied history and all of the rest of it. And it is venerable in very many different ways. And for that, it can be overlooked. It can be presumed to be, you know, staid and the antithesis of innovation, and that it has, you know, a huge amount of vested interest in maintaining the status quo. We would argue that the opposite is true, actually. If we look at the contribution that Toyota has made over the last 20 years to a transition to a lower carbon economy. And I'm not sure we were using exactly those terms, you know, 20 years ago, but that is essentially what happened when, you know, when the Prius was launched. You know, the number of Priuses and other Toyota branded hybrid vehicles that have been sold over that period, I think means that we can say that Toyota has done arguably more than perhaps any other company, and certainly as much as most other companies, to try and ameliorate some of those growing environmental problems that, you know, we are now absolutely front and center. We think about a lot, but Toyota's been thinking about for some time. Mm. It gets criticized for that, almost for that, right? Because it's been successful in hybrids, the presumption is that the move away from hybrids will be suppressed or will be, you know, will be dragged back by Toyota. We think that's not the case, actually. We think that Toyota has very good technology in batteries. You know, they're doing a lot of work on solid state batteries, which will make batteries for EVs safer and easier and better to use. It's also done an enormous amount of R&D in hydrogen, which, you know, a few years ago when Toyota was talking about the Mirai, so Mirai is Japanese for future, mm-hmm. the Mirai model, you know, Toyota was a bit of a laughing stock, right? People thought that it was crazy. But actually now much less so. And hydrogen is being seen as a more likely plausible longer term part of the propulsion mix, if that makes sense. So I think, you know, when we're investing in these sectors where domestic growth is very likely to be minimal, global growth even might well be minimal, then we have to look for innovation and where share can be taken. And that's really where Toyota stands out. I think it is in a really good position. Of course, you know, there are short-term issues that Toyota and all other companies, you know, have to go through. You know, whether that's, you know, chip shortage or other supply issues coming from coronavirus pandemic in Southeast Asia, etc. You know, those sorts of things are, pardon the pun, they are sort of speed bumps, right? They're bumps in the road. But Toyota is really, really well placed to go through them, get on past them and really sort of prosper. So yeah, there are big names in the portfolio, but there's always a mid to longer term reason why we think that company will not only be still standing, but will actually be strengthening through the cycle rather than weakening.
Well, thanks very much, Dan. That's very interesting. You know, that also seems to encapsulate quite a lot of what we've talked through today. So maybe it's a good point to wrap things up. Dan, thank you very much again for joining me. It was a pleasure to talk to you and really interesting to learn more about your approach and investing in Japan.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. And the final thing to add from me is thank you very much for listening today. Please join us again soon for more Funds Fanatic Show podcasts.